With this presentation today, my aim is to describe how the Edison Company selected artists and repertoire for the Diamond Disc record catalog during the 1910s. In particular, I'll focus on the intended marketing strategy for the Diamond Disc and explain how this plan conflicted with the increased public demand for hit records around World War I. These issues surround a debate between two of the key decision makers at Edison and perhaps can inform an understanding of some larger trends. And I want to explain before I get started, this is part of a larger study that I'm doing for some graduate work that will cover a larger time period going into the 20s. And in the 20s, I'll look specifically at how they dealt with the rise in popularity of jazz records. But my focus today is narrower. I'm focusing mainly on the 1910s. And so you'll see I'll use a few examples of jazz, but that's not something I'm going to focus on. That whole controversy really gets heated up in the early mid-20s. In many ways, the first decade of the Diamond Disc record can be viewed as an attempt to put into practice a widely held perspective that was prominent in the United States between the years 1900 and 1920. Researcher Mark Katz, in an article appearing in the winter 1998 issue of the journal American Music, describes how the phonograph in the first two decades of the 20th century was valued as a potential means of musical progress. Many, many music teachers, critics, patrons, performers, and phonograph owners shared the belief that the phonograph would help America become, quote, a truly musical nation. As Mr. Katz describes, the following perceptions were common. First of all, love of beautiful art made people in the world better. Second, classical music in particular was a powerful cultural and moral force. Third, only Europe produced such first-class or good music. And fourth, most Americans sadly lacked access to it. The phonograph, therefore, could play a role in reaching a democratic ideal that all members of society, if they owned a phonograph, could hear and benefit from good music. Furthermore, because sound recordings were repeatable, the phonograph could teach the public to differentiate good music from bad. Proponents of this view believed that upon repeated listening, phonograph owners would grow tired of popular music, like ragtime or vaudeville show tunes, and find classical music more appealing. Repeated listenings of classical music on the phonograph, it was believed, could make Americans better people, both morally and culturally. However, by the 1930s, these attitudes towards music and the phonograph changed considerably. Interest in popular music was still as strong as ever, and sales of phonographs had dropped to a minimum, eclipsed by radio and motion pictures. A parallel to this nationwide situation can be seen in the following chart. And I've laid this out. On the bottom you have, it's organized by year, 1912 through 1929. And going upwards are quantity of records released by the Edison Company on Diamond Disc per year. And the Edison catalog for Diamond Disc was basically divided into three main categories. First of all, in the purple color, you have the 50,000 series, which sold those Diamond Discs sold for $1 each. And those were mainly popular records, hit type records, or novelties. And then the 80,000 series, which here is represented in blue, sold for $1.50 each. And those were more kind of standard, older, popular songs, ballads, usually sung in a very formalized style. And then the higher priced records were in the 82,000 to 84,000 series, running from $2 up to $4. And those were the most formal operatic and instrumental classical records, usually sung by the better known higher paid performers who receive royalties. And as you can see, the numbers released per year with which each category changed. After about 1921, they're putting out many, many more 50,000 series and fewer of the higher priced, more formal classical music records. Prior to 1921, it was pretty well evenly balanced. I'll begin my historical interpretation of this study with a look at the development phase of the Edison disc record. On a Friday morning in March of 1911, readers of the Philadelphia Leader opened their newspapers to this headline. Oops. Edison will learn music. And you can see he's saying up here, "When I was young, I was denied an opportunity to develop myself aesthetically. Now I'm trying to do so. Last night, I waded through several hundred compositions." And it also says in the articles that his main conclusion was that, that's down here. Arrived at the conclusion that originality is a rare thing and plagiarism is a usual thing in musical compositions. So, let's see here. It's significant that Edison chose to study music at this time. The following year, Thomas A. Edison Incorporated would introduce a new record format, the Diamond Disc, designed to compete with the Victor Talking Machine's highly successful catalog of music. Throughout the era of the wax cylinder record, Edison had concerned himself primarily with the technological and business management related aspects of the phonograph. Purely musical concerns were delegated to lower level subordinates in the company. The start of the Diamond Disc marked a change in Edison's role, chief of artists and repertoire. For the first time since the start of the phonograph industry, it was undeniably clear that the musical content of the records was of the utmost significance. By the end of 1911, Edison outlined his plans for the new record catalog. Believing he possessed a technological advantage over his competitors, Edison chose to depend primarily upon the sound quality of a performer on record, distinct from any reputation an artist may or may not have as a stage performer. Live performers, he reasoned, often achieve success due largely to a charismatic stage presence. With the phonograph, however, those mostly appearance-based elements of stage presence were absent. Also, given the limitations of phonograph recording, certain live sounds, like particular singers' voices, specific musical instruments, or types of ensembles, when recorded, did not sound as natural or realistic as others. Therefore, he thought, what should matter most to serious record buyers is the actual reproduction of sound coming from the record. In Edison's mind, the use of celebrity stage performers as recording artists was essentially an expensive and somewhat misleading form of advertising, something that a product of quality should not require. He explained this perspective in a letter to a business manager in Berlin. And in these document slides, I've shaded out the parts that I'm not focusing on, and the white parts are what I'm quoting. "There are, of course, many people who will buy a distorted, ill-recorded, scratchy record if the singer has a great reputation. But there are infinitely more who will buy for the beauty of the record, with fine voices, well-instrumented, and no scratch. These are lovers of good music and are the constant and continuous buyers of records. Hence, I propose to put out only this type, even in the popular. According to Edison's vision, potential customers need only to hear a diamond disc record on an Edison phonograph. Once done, the exceptional realism of sound would sell itself. And hence, that's why they really focused on promoting the diamond disc by allowing people to hear it live by promotions such as like the tone test, where a performer would travel around with the diamond disc phonograph and compare the live sound to the recorded sound. They also did things like what they call the turntable comparison, where a phonograph dealership would have a Victor phonograph next to an Edison phonograph, and the potential customers would sit and listen to each. Relatively little money, therefore, need be spent on print advertising. This approach contrasted with the Victor Company's practice of recording celebrated live performers, then advertising those records heavily. Regarding repertoire, in an early statement of policy, he wrote, quote, "Any new tune that is published which is melodious and which seems to have merit enough, and it's of such a character that gives a promise of sustained popularity over a long period, should be sent to the Oranges to be judged to see if worthy to be put in the tune book," unquote. Edison was in search of repertoire that had merit. In other words, long-term aesthetic value, such that it would prove to sell steadily over time. Specifically, he identified a flowing melody as an essential characteristic for music that had merit. William Maxwell, a young college-educated business executive, was hired in the spring of 1911 as vice president of the corporation's musical phonograph division and general manager of marketing. And there you see Edison standing out of the main lab outside of the main lab building with William Maxwell on the right, and also one of the corporation executives, C.H. Wilson, on the left. That's another shot of Maxwell at his desk. To become acquainted with the phonograph business, Maxwell began his term of employment with an extensive trip throughout the United States, visiting and speaking with phonograph distributors, dealers, and customers. Upon his return, he submitted a detailed report on the status of the business and made recommendations for new directions. In the report, Maxwell pointed to the Victor Company as their most significant rival. Edison was still strong in rural areas with the cylinder phonograph, but Victor, largely via promotion of prestigious recording artists, had achieved popularity among urban class and upper middle class customers. If left unchallenged, Victor would likely soon gain a dominant status among influential country dwellers as well, threatening the base of Edison's phonograph business. Maxwell stressed that the choice of musical content for the new record catalog was critical. And starting at the top, quote, "The phonograph has practically ceased to be a novelty and is regarded with indifference or aversion by those who do not recognize it as a superior kind of musical instrument." And then skipping down, "Our most important relation to the public is that of a producer of music, and our commercial success will be proportionate to our success in producing the kind of music that people will desire to have in their homes for frequent repetition." In the selection of record subjects, we should raise our standards as much as possible without the alienation of those whose preference runs to low class selections. Unquote. As this passage indicates, Maxwell, like Edison, placed a high priority on longevity of interest. If the business was to endure, the public must not lose interest in listening to or buying records. Continuing in the report, Maxwell described the theoretical basis for his outlook. That's too soon there. Like others of his era, he believed that the average person, given the opportunity, had an inherent ability to experience an evolutionary progression of musical tastes. By his viewpoint, virtually anyone could realize a lifelong interest in music, but this was dependent upon the type of music available. For example, if a person heard only ragtime, in time, he or she inevitably would reach the conclusion that they have become tired of all music. However, if that same person were introduced progressively to, quote, better classes of music, they would eventually develop a taste even for grand opera, and thereafter have a lifelong interest in music. Therefore, Maxwell thought, in order to make the phonograph more than a dying novelty, it was necessary to educate the public. A certain controlled amount of popular music was needed as an introduction to sell the phonograph, but in order to perpetuate the sale of records over the long term, it was necessary to encourage and inspire phonograph owners to develop an interest in classical music. Maxwell's viewpoint was not at all unique. It was a common perspective for the time. Historian Neil Leonard, in his book Jazz and the White Americans, describes how influential American musical leaders after the turn of the century, such as Walter Damrosch, saw it as their social mission to educate the public with traditional European concert music. Too much popular music, they believed, could smother a person's natural instinct for good music. For example, orchestral conductor Theodore Thomas is quoted to have said, quote, "If a person does not like Wagner, then they must hear him till they do." Advertisements for the Diamond Disc Record during the 1910s reflected this type of outlook. And this is from a musical magazine that Edison published called Along Broadway. And you can see it starts off by saying, It is a fact that at first hearing catchy tunes have a stronger appeal than classical music, but the taste does not last nearly so well. And then down here they're getting the idea of repetition on the phonograph. Repetition is a great educator. The great influence of the phonograph in cultivating a taste for better class of music is due to the ease which with those who cannot produce music themselves are able to play notable selections over and over again. And Edison seems to have gone along with this idea. You don't see him talking a lot about it behind the scenes privately, but in public correspondence especially, he promotes the same idea. This is a letter written in 1914 from a customer who owned an Edison phonograph asking for more classical music. And this is Edison's reply here. He says, "I have a host of fine classical record masters ready to print, but the public demand trashy stuff and dance music. Real musical people are not plenty. However, I'm proceeding to record much high-grade pieces which I will issue even if the dealers say no sale." So, similar. And he's doing a lot of the, well, people would write him personally and he would reply. And you see a lot of things like that. To accommodate Mr. Edison's interest in artists and repertoire, An office space was organized on the third floor of the West. An office space was organized on the third floor of West Orange Laboratory, Building 5. Clarence Hayes, a vocalist and professional bookkeeper, was hired in 1912 to sight read songs and organize a library of suitable music musical compositions. And it's a little hard to see, but Hayes is in the center there speaking on the telephone.
Jerry, is that a bit cold?
Yeah. I wish this were more clear, but this setup here seems to be Edison's little sitting space, because there's a Victor and Edison and a Columbia machine, and then you have a table here with some paper and a pencil, and then you also have, which kind of clues you into it being Edison's spot, is it's a horn with a piece of like a felt pad on the small end, and that's something that we know he used as a hearing aid for listening, because he was hard of hearing. Let's see. By 1917, the music room had a staff of four, including Hayes as head, a pianist, and two clerical employees. When Edison had available time, he would sit and evaluate music and recordings. All potential vocalists first made a trial record, which required approval from Edison before they could be released on a dime a disc. Edison also passed on compositions. In his absence, a committee of employees led by Hayes acted on Edison's behalf. As an illustration of the process through which a musician became a dime a disc recording artist, and because I'm focusing on the hit record, I'll briefly describe the making of two of the earliest records marketed by Edison as jazz. Staff members at the Fifth Avenue Manhattan recording studio carried out most of the scout work for new artists. Scout work meaning they would go out and hear live music or just keep an eye open for what was happening. And this is a picture of the Manhattan recording studio staff. Third from the right is Walter Miller, who Patrick Feaster mentioned. And this guy here is looks like Cronkite, who was one of the music arrangers. On the far end, I think looks to me like that was Sodero, who was one of the conductors. And it looks like they're doing some scout work there at an opera house. Following the highly successful premiere of the original Dixieland Jazz Band recordings on Victor in March of 1917, recording manager Walter Miller enlisted the Frisco Jazz Band. This just sheds a little light on what was going on. This is a letter from one of the advertising employees, and he's writing to Hayes saying, "How about a jazz band record on the disc? Several dealers at a recent Minneapolis convention asked me about this." And so apparently they're getting requests, you know, from all over the country already by that point, in May of 1917. And then Hayes down at the bottom replies, "Mr. Walter Miller is after a jazz combination, and I think we will have some records soon." On lead clarinet and saxophone was Rudy Weedoff, who in February of that year had achieved his first noteworthy acclaim as a soloist in the Broadway musical Canary Cottage at the Marasco Theater. On May 10th, two selections by the Frisco Jazz Band were recorded at the Edison Studio in New York City. Back in West Orange at the Phonograph Works, a set of test prints, were made and forwarded to the laboratory music room. Employees of the music room routinely prepared notebooks containing lists of recordings for Edison to hear and evaluate. At the top of each notebook page for test prints was written the matrix number, title, and artist. And then Edison would fill in his write his evaluations below. With the Frisco Jazz Band's first recording, Canary Cottage, Hayes included a short introductory note. That's up on the left. He says, jazz bands are very popular at present throughout the country. They play for dancing with a lot of pep. And the first side, Edison's reply is, this is okay. And the second side, he writes, only fair. The high instrument, supposedly a violin, is very wheezy and spoils all. If the violin was played lower in a lower key, it would be okay. So Edison's criticisms at this point focused on technical quality of the recording and arrangements of instruments. As I've described, the strategy outlined by Edison and Maxwell was to gradually establish a catalog of music that would sell steadily over time. However, as they came to find, increasingly this ran against a growing trend of hit records. And just by way of definition, the way they were defining the word hit, the way Edison and Maxwell were defining that word, was any newly composed song that, due to its probable novelty value, often would sell in large quantities upon its release, but usually only for a very short period of time. And after a few weeks or months, the demand would most likely drop to almost nothing. Music researcher Edward F. Gardner recently published a statistical analysis of the most popular songs in the United States during the first half of the 20th century. In his book, Popular Songs of the 20th Century, he demonstrates that in the earlier years of the phonograph industry, record companies generally did not record a song until it was already a proven success through sheet music sales or live performances. However, by the end of World War I, the influence of the phonograph had grown to the point at which records themselves were creating hits independently. An ever-increasing number of songs received widespread exposure. Songs became faster and remained in demand for shorter periods of time. With increased exposure for new songs came an increased demand for musical styles. As a result, record companies could no longer simply wait to see what new music would be popular. At Edison, realization of this development is documented in a memo to Clarence Hayes, February of 1919. This is from one of the managers. He's writing to Hayes saying, we've always been more or less influenced by the idea that popular hits originate on the Atlantic coast and would work more or less slowly westward. And then he describes how some phonograph owners out in California were complaining about lateness of hits. And he says, this indicates that the talking machine records are an active medium in popularizing new hits. The talking machine records are released simultaneously all over the country. This should modify somewhat our idea that hits travel from east to west. In the business of sheet music, the hit song was not a new phenomenon. As early as the 1880s, a number of American music publishers specialized in newly composed popular music. By the 1890s, a popular song industry emerged. Known as Tin Pan Alley, it centered around 28th Street in New York City. Techniques of successful hit song makers reflected the methods of the emerging modern industrial urban economy. Basically, find out what the public wants and sell it to them as hard as possible. Through monitoring of public reaction and intensive marketing, Tin Pan Alley music publishers essentially created hits. Typically, publishers gave free copies of a new song to professional performers and then carefully observed public reaction at initial performances. Oftentimes, the most influential performers received payment to introduce a song. If a song yielded a positive response, a limited number of discount copies were distributed for retail sale. Given further demonstration of potential by healthy sales, publishers distributed the sheet music widely and advertised heavily in newspapers, music journals, and on sheet music jackets. So the development of a hit song by Tin Pan Alley publishers had relatively little to do with any idea of merit. By the close of the 1910s, overall results of the new Edison disc format did not rival the Victor or Columbia organizations, but an overall trend of steady growth, bolstered by a booming post-war economy, encouraged optimism. That's just some sales statistics there. And you can see between 1912 and 1919, it was pretty steady growth. However, overall demographics of sales had not changed significantly. Edison phonographs still sold primarily outside of the major cities, mostly to farmers and rural areas. Furthermore, a new kind of problem had developed. While customers bought and were satisfied with Edison disc phonographs, the vertically cut groove Edison disc records did not sell in proportion to the machines. Typically, Edison disc phonograph owners sooner or later bought a reproducer adapter, enabling them to play lateral cut records made by the competition. Among the most common complaints about the Diamond Disc record, two were related to artists and repertoire. First of all, artists on the Edison discs were inferior to those on the competitors' records, and secondly, popular hits were either not released at all or delayed, often released after the other record companies or after the song was no longer in demand. The increased public demand for new material weakened Edison's and Maxwell's strategy of building a stable catalog to sell steadily over time. At the same time, Edison's rejection of any increase in funds for print advertising severely limited Maxwell. As head of marketing, he could not follow the Tin Pan Alley method of heavily promoting potential hits. In Edison's judgment, as a general rule, advertising for any article that was made obsolete by subsequent advertisements was a waste of money. In other words, he did not intend the Diamond Disc to be a disposable item. Under heightened pressure to sell more records, differences of opinion were debated. On the subject of hits, Maxwell believed that they must give the public what they demand, though in controlled amounts. In a memo on the record situation dated June of 1919, Maxwell wrote, quote, "The ordinary man and woman are our salvation, and while I think it is good business to attempt to elevate their musical tastes, we have to catch them first. And a reasonable amount of trash seems to be good bait." Particularly in the cities and large towns where we are at present weakest. Cautioning Edison against the practice of building a record catalog based only on one's personal judgment, he added, "Personally, I detest ragtime, jazz, etc. If my personal tastes controlled our lists, they'd be quite different than they are. But I believe there's a great danger in permitting our personal tastes to control." In Edison's reply to this memo, conflicting viewpoint is clear. I'll read this. "Maxwell, your note about the record situation shows that you have entirely and completely misunderstood what I've been saying. I myself like some jazz and also some ragtime songs." I think there he's talking for sake of argument, probably. "I do not like highbrow stuff generally. What I complain of is that of 20 songs, 8 jazz, 4 comics, 6 or 8 dance tunes that possibly comes out a month, no one connected with our force has the capacity or judgment enough to cull out the few things we desire to put on monthly. But they take them just as Victor of Columbia does, haphazard. The way I do it is to have them all played or sung and find the most tuneful, the ones that suit our voices, that permit a chorus, that are not duplicates of tunes we already have. That a tune has no weak volume spots which will show our scratch. That a tune has a good introduction and accompaniment, and that it will likely be a pleasing composition 5 years from now, and that we are not liable to have it returned because it is unsaleable. I maintain that we should put out each month only the cream of the new stuff and get out more of the best music, like I'll Take You Home Again, Kathleen. Kathleen Mavourneen, Ave Maria, etc. This memo illustrates that a divergence of approach had developed between Edison and Maxwell. While both preferred to manufacture records that would have an enduring, continuous appeal, Edison, at least privately, was not thinking in terms of trying to elevate the taste of the public towards classical music. His search for music with merit included the popular genres, even new material. Although with a strong, he's always putting this really, really strong emphasis on a flowing melody, and that comes into play a little bit later with when jazz really becomes more of an issue. Okay. Late in the year 1920, a brief post-war economic boom that aided the phonograph industry came to an abrupt halt when the nation's economy suffered a severe downturn. Threatened with the survival of the entire corporation, Edison reacted with drastic cuts in both management and factory personnel. Amid downsizing, Maxwell, as well as music room head Clarence Hayes, left the company. Budget cuts at the musical phonograph division included a major curtailment of the already limited spending on print advertising. November and December of 1921 witnessed the termination of three house publications supportive of the phonograph business, the Along Broadway magazine, and also the trade journals Edison Diamond Points and Edison Amberola Monthly. The year 1921 marked a turning point for Edison's phonograph business, the end of an upward trend in sales and the onset of the final 9-year downward decline. And you see, after 1920, it just really bottoms out fast. Major changes were underway throughout the phonograph industry. With the overturning in court of the fundamental patents on the lateral cut disc record, many newer labels entered the market with low-priced lateral cut records. By the mid-1920s, the influence of radio intensified enormously the persistent demand for new musical hits. And I'm just going to summarize the 20s very, very quickly. As I touched upon at the start of this talk, record catalogs after 1920 included higher percentages of new popular songs and dance numbers. However, selection decisions continued for the most part to be based on an estimation of aesthetic value or compositional merit. So, during their final decade, Edison and Company made an effort to conform to popular demand for hit songs and new musical styles, but because of severe limits on advertising and Edison's refusal to adopt the lateral cut disc format, the public barely noticed any of this effort. The years following World War I in the United States are often characterized as a time of transition from a Victorian era to a modern era. Historian Roderick Nash, who refers to this time period as the nervous generation, writes, quote, "So much of the 1920s was new and disturbing that Americans tended to cling tightly to familiar economic forms. They just could not bear to admit that old business premises might be fraught with peril," unquote. With a rapidly expanding consumer market for mass-produced items of culture, Edison's 19th century style approach, based more on notions of individualism and craftsmanship, could not succeed on a wide scale. The idea of selling records by virtue of aesthetic merit was not completely without basis. As Tin Pan Alley historian Nicholas E. Tawa writes, quote, "No matter how clever and persistent the publicity given a song, at the end, it had to succeed on its own merits. But, equally as true, an excellent song might easily go nowhere without carefully thought out promotion and sponsorship." Though, of course, the question with Edison is, could one person alone, or even one committee alone, determine if a new piece of music would have long-term aesthetic value for the general phonograph-buying public? Wouldn't the element of personal taste always enter into the equation? On the topic of selling songs, Tin Pan Alley composer Harry von Tilzer once explained, quote, "The popular song has become a commodity with a cash value, and in order to augment the value, one must subordinate his own personal taste to those of the music-buying public," unquote. According to Edison, though, the Diamond Disc catalog during the 1910s was weighted heavily with melodious, sentimental ballads, not simply because he liked them, but as a business strategy based on what would sell most reliably over time. And in conclusion, what Edison did not anticipate was the degree to which the entertainment industry would develop into a business based on high volume, low priced, heavily advertised, instantly consumable records. This development was part of wider trends. The practice of advertising an item that was promptly made obsolete by subsequent advertisements became the model for much of the modern economy. Questions? Any time for questions? Anyone have any questions or comments or arguments? I'm not sure the quantity he actually sold, or because the chart I was showing was number released. Excuse me?
Well, I thought it showed also in your last chart, no, not that one, but the previous one. There you go. It showed how many machines were sold and how many discs were sold.
But if you divide the number of machines that have been sold over the years into the number of records that are sold over the years, Edison Phonograph owners didn't have a very large collection.
And also that includes,
they pick up so much more.
This is total sales, so it includes Blue Amberols. There are a lot of cylinder machines out there.
That also includes sales to jobbers that never went any farther.
That's true.
In records, and you find dealer stock.
Yeah,
tons of
that's true.
Mm-hmm. Never sold.
Right, right.
Is Steve? That chart actually a number of items or dollar value?
Items. The second and third columns are items. Tim.
There's a lot of documentation about Edison and his musical taste and his melody and the things you were talking about. And yet, even in the teens, his catalog seems to have a good deal of columns of Harlan, and there's probably some fans here, but things that you would think were pretty ephemeral and probably not very high on his own.
Right, right. I think just Edison and Maxwell, who seem to be the two kind of people making policies, knew that they had to release a certain amount.
Trash.
Of what they were calling trash. And I don't know that Edison didn't like Collins and Harlan. You know, I think that he was.
He liked old colored jokes.
Yeah.
He liked jokes.
But I think a lot of his evaluations were based on sound quality. I think they knew that they had to release a certain amount of popular stuff, and they were getting a lot of letters like the one I showed you, or not unlike the one I showed you, where people were saying, we want more popular music. So they knew that they had to release a certain amount of that, but they were trying to kind of keep that limited and just as a way to get people interested in the records that they thought would sell better over time. Yeah.
And all of that. But a lot of people were still hearing that music, you know, as relatively fresh, and because phonograph records were only beginning to circulate in mass quantities throughout the country, Edison, Victor, and everyone else included. What left Edison behind was he had no artist budget, you know, so there were no stars. So as people like your Dixieland Jazz Band, Marion Harris, and Paul Whiteman were beginning, and Joel Smith, stars in their own right, mm-hmm. for other labels, Edison had no, you know, no comparable personalities. And then finally, when everyone else abandoned the vertical recording deal, that's when he should have checked out on 1929.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
He had absolutely nothing to offer after that. If he had taken his own advice seriously, gone into the country where his customers were in 1930,
yeah, that would
and recorded the music in the country that those people were playing, today's history would be a whole lot.
Yeah, I agree. I think a lot of it's just the trends in the larger music industry and just the economy in general.
Yeah. To your knowledge, did Edison ever review personally the Edison cylinders made in Milan, London, and Paris, which most of which are
which,
extremely high quality, relative.
What years are you speaking about?
I
believe so, yeah.
1912, 1905. Edison didn't have any say in those, did he?
I don't think that he really paid much close attention prior to when they started up the Diamond Disc.
Because he had some very fine artists then, mm-hmm. that were recording for Edison, while the local artists weren't in quite in the same class.
Yeah. It's very clear that he doesn't enter into the artisan repertoire until the Diamond Disc, and that's his main focus. So it's unclear who really was in charge of that prior to him, and that's just due to the fact that what was saved, you know, the what tended to be saved was whatever related to Edison. So if he wasn't working on it, it wasn't preserved, you know, by the company or by the Park Service or in the early stages when they were, you know.
Do you know who was in charge of the branch offices in London and Paris and Milan especially?
There's some information, but I really haven't focused on that. So, Steve?
I have a different take on Dick's comment about early country performers would have been recorded by Edison. It's not who was being listened to, it's who was buying the records. And I have broadcast in 1935 of a Purina chow or farm animal for chicken series of programs, and they are all of music for it sounds like it's taken right out of the Victor 1900 catalog. It's all of that quality. Now the point I'm making is that even in 1935 the farmers who were in their 40s and 50s who were making the buying decisions, this is how Purina was able to reach them. The program ran through 5 years or something like that at least. And that, I made it actually a copy of it for Dick, because it seems such an absurd thing on the face of it to be the people who, the kind of music that was being offered to farmers and country people. But when you think about it, it's the buying power. The idea of the teens being or the people in their 20s having the buying power, I think is a piece of the evolution of this business.
Yeah.
And it's the demographics of the buyers that have actually made the catalogs function.
Yeah, you get the sense.
The music that those people were buying who could afford it.
Right. You get the sense that they were still really figuring that out, that it was mainly the younger people in the homes where the phonographs were who were most interested in the records, that wasn't entirely clear to them.
I want want to interrupt a minute.
Okay.
First of all, it was fantastic. Thank you. I want to first. There's coffee and pastry in the back, and I thought maybe we could continue talking, if it's okay with you, if it's okay with Jerry, while people who want a cup of coffee do it. Although most, I see a lot who want one have one. But maybe we could continue so we could sort of stay on time. Is David Patmore here? Good, thank you. I hadn't seen you, so that's good. And maybe if Malcolm is willing and if Patrick Feaster is willing, if you have questions for them that you didn't have an opportunity to ask, we might do that now too. And there are exhibits in the back room here, the gazebo or whatever it's called.